I'm told my guest is on board, so let's go over and say hello to my guest. He is Dr. Alberto Fioldo, and he is a psychologist. He's a medical anthropologist. He was the youngest clinical professor at San Francisco State University and ran the Biological Self-Regulation Laboratory, investigating how energy medicine could change brain chemistry. And after realizing there was more to healing than what would be observed in a laboratory, he commenced on an exploration of the healing practices and spiritual teachings of indigenous people in the Amazonian and Andes Mountains regions that would become his life work for the last 30 years. He's founder of the Four Winds Society, which teaches shamanic psychology and physical healing based upon the Inca tradition of the Andes, and is founder of the Sanctuary Project, which supplies shelter to the master healers in Peru. And he's the author of 10 books, which include works co-written with Professor Stanley Krippner, who I've had on this program several times, including Illumination, the Shamanic Way of Healing. Nice to have you with us today.
Thank you, Gary. Good to be here.
People are suffering today, in my belief, at least more than ever before, as the population of the planet starts to reach 7 billion, and more fall into poverty. I've just been all over the United States, all over the world, filming a new documentary on the new poor. Now, that is not to suggest that the old poor, meaning those who historically have been poor, those on the low-income bracket, those who are uneducated, those who tend to be in rural America, different places like Louisiana and Alabama, those people have a great deal of poverty in their midst. This is a whole new phenomenon. These are the new poor, people who a year ago were living in a home or apartment, who were buying things, enjoying themselves, and today they're homeless. They are incapable at this moment emotionally of accepting that they can tolerate this. You see an enormous amount of drug use, alcoholism, spousal abuse, child abuse. People are losing it out there, and yet none of this have I seen reported in the mainstream media. I do see some of these people showing up at rallies around the country and voicing their concern, but before they hadn't protested anything. 99% of the people I speak with now, they didn't raise their voices when there were other groups or other conditions. They just were disconnected from the idea that they should be responsible. Now we're immersed in the emotional and psychological suffering, particularly in the United States with an epidemic of antidepressant drug use. Our health agencies, through fear-mongering, make us fearful of the slightest microbe, a swine flu virus, a little more than a common cold, but we demonize life around us more and more and continue on the path of trying to dominate nature with the best and brightest of high-tech and drugs, Wall Street finance, and religious morality. And finally, from your perspective as a psychologist and shamanic healer, what do you believe is the fundamental cause of suffering in Western society? And I use this term civilization specifically because it has been the dominant paradigm that offers the mythology that humans rule over nature and the rest of life. The form is yours.
You know, Gary, I'm a medical anthropologist, and I started my research at a brain laboratory at the University of California, studying how we could create psychosomatic health. We know that we can create psychosomatic disease, but the question that we were facing was whether we could create psychosomatic health. And after a few years of research, I realized that I was looking out of the wrong end of the microscope, that instead of going smaller and smaller, that I had to go bigger and bigger, even perhaps to step out of my culture, because I was trained as a Western scientist, and to go and to immerse myself in a culture where even the notions of time and space and mythology and poverty were completely different from the ones that we have in the West. So I packed up my lab and I gave up a promising career in academia and headed down to the jungle, where I spent nearly 25 years living and studying the shamans, the men and women that mediated between the visible and the invisible world, which we had come to dismiss pretty much in the West as non-existent. But the invisible world for the shamans was not only the world of spirits, it was also the world of microbes, which, as we know, are invisible to the naked eye. And they believed that there was no difference between being killed by a microbe and being killed by a jaguar, that you had to be in good relationships with microbes and with jaguars, otherwise they were both going to be looking at you as lunch. So what I discovered with the healing practices was that they had to do with being in right relationship. And when you were not in right relationship, you became ill. Now, this was right relationship with your village, with your family, with your environment, with the jungle, with your ecosystem. And if you look at the Western mythology, where we were given the garden to basically cut it down, chop it, and assuming that all of the food in the world belongs to us, it's no wonder that we have come out of right relationship with the earth. And you have things like Ebola viruses that used to be contained to a 20-square-mile area. Once you cut these trees down, the Ebola spreads naturally. So even though the Western approach to healing, to medicine, has to do with defeating the microbes, giving them antibiotics, bombing them out of existence, the indigenous approach is that you have to befriend them and be in right relationship with them, much as we're in right relationship with all of the bugs that live inside of our gut and that help us to digest and absorb nutrients from food. We know that if your intestinal flora is out of balance, that you become ill. In fact, your GI tract is it's the home to more than 10 pounds of bugs, 2,000 different varieties of them that all live in harmony with us and that help us to be able to nourish ourselves. So what I discovered with the indigenous mythologies is that the first step to healing was to enter into a sustainable relationship with your environment. And when you don't, then you become ill. And when you have as many people living in the earth as we do today, out of right relationship with the planet and utilizing the cream of the resources. You know, we've cut down all of the old growth forests. We've washed away so much of the topsoil into the ocean and into the rivers. So what took hundreds of thousands of years to develop, we have used in the last 50 years. And I believe that so many of the illnesses and problems, including poverty, that we face today in the world are due to this Western mythology of having the earth given to us to do as we please, and the other Western myth of progress. And we believe that progress is the cure for poverty. But I've spent many years in the third world, and what I've observed is that poverty is actually the result of progress, of people that are uprooted from a traditional lifestyle and put to work building a dam, and then 10 years later they're out of a job and there's no way of going back to the village and to the land. So I think that we're coming to a place of having to seriously re-examine the assumptions that we have about how we can live sustainably here in this very small planet that we live in.
I appreciate that. I appreciate that oversight. Now, why we can speak of individuals having deep-seated wounds in the energy fields due to traumas and wrongful attitudes taken in life, there's also a sort of collective energy field, something Erwin Laszlo, who I interviewed earlier this year, addressed in his definitions of a aksha. And today, this collective field serves like a matrix, similar to the Keanu Reeves film of that name. We are we're in the field and go through the drama that we are awake in environmentally, socially, civil rights, and all these other worthy and honorable causes, but we're still reactionary to the dictates and languages and beliefs and systems and corporate media and entertainment of the wealthy and powerful who define and control this matrix. It's not our matrix. We didn't get together and create it. Someone else did. We're in it.
But you know,
just let me finish this thought and then take your time and address it. It's all very circular, regardless of where our values lie, as long as we are stuck in a reactionary mode. Therefore, the real warrior journey for spiritual independence and illumination might be our path to learn how to escape from this matrix that civilization has defined for us. And I would guess, well, I'm not going to guess. I'm going to ask you, how do you understand this collective matrix and the roots of its existence? And then what would be the steps you would advise a person to embark on as a path to step outside of it? Or is it even possible to step outside it? Or perhaps is it necessary to have a foot in both fields?
You know, Gary, I used to, when I was in graduate school and I was taking trips to the Amazon, I'd come back to the U.S. to work as a psychologist. And I worked with Head Start schools that, as you know, are schools for underprivileged children. And I was a psychologist for about 600 kids. And the very first day of school, I would ask them to draw a house. And these kids would draw the most amazing houses. Inside the roots of trees, in the clouds. One of them even drew a house inside a jelly donut. And the very last day of school, at the end of a year, they were 7 years old now, I would ask them to draw a house, and they would all draw a little rectangle with a triangle roof and a door and two windows. So they had already been indoctrinated into what I call the cultural trance that is so invisible to us at this point that it's very difficult to wake up from. Now, with the shamans that I studied in the Amazon and in the high Andes, they said that the first step to healing was to break up from this trance, from the set of beliefs and assumptions that had become unconscious to us, and that even get transmitted when you're in the womb, because the stress hormones that a mother feels go right through the placental barrier, and they begin to inform the fetus. So by the time we're born, we come out of the womb, 50% of our personality is already formed. If the mother's happy, the fetus is happy. If the mother feels like she's in a marriage that is not safe, or in a neighborhood that's not safe, or she's not going to have enough to eat, the child picks that up, and they spend their lives living in a world that is not safe and not having enough to eat and gorging and putting on tremendous amount of weight and projecting and living in a state of fear that is really the result of a set of preconceptions, of a cultural trance. So what really intrigued me about living and being in the Amazon with the shamans, and believe me, it wasn't easy, because I was a city boy, and I was used to room service. And here I was in the most godforsaken part of the Amazon jungle, 3 days to the nearest telephone, and 4 days to the nearest cold beer, and discovering that these individuals lived in a completely different reality, that they were provided for by the jungle, that they had free time, that they were not feeling like they were in a state of constant threat. You know, in the morning, I'd turn on Fox Television News just to see what level of terror I'm supposed to be experiencing that day. So so we live in a world that is, there's a lot of people that make a huge amount of money by keeping us feeling afraid. And when you begin to wake up from the trance, then you realize that you're not living in a hostile world, that the jaguars and the microbes are not out to eat you, that Keynesian economics that says that there's not enough to go around for everyone is absolutely absurd, and that we can have a sustainable and peaceful relationship with our village and our environment, and particularly with ourselves, so that we can heal the war that is raging inside of each one of us. So the first step was waking up from the nightmare of history and the nightmare that we had been educated into even before we were born. So, and that's very difficult to do with our Western therapies that insist on working on our problems, because at the core of the shamanic teachings is that your stories or your problems or your dilemmas are simply a story that keep you victimized. And victimhood is the distinct characteristic of people and individuals that are living within this trance, within this cultural trance that's intent on keeping us as disempowered victims. Now, this might seem like a pretty radical thought, but this is what I found in the among these indigenous peoples that lacked technology but had a deep sense of communion with the garden, with the jungle, with nature.
Hmm. Thank you. I really appreciate that insight. For the past 8 years, even longer since we saw it in the wine and dine boom of the Clinton years, we could feel deeply this rapid increase in apathy that seems to be pervading our society, as if people are completely disempowered because the increased concentrations of wealth that you discussed and power among the ruling elite. And consequently, in general, we find less acting on noble ideals to counter injustice today than we did in previous decades, unless you went back to the 1960s. How can you account for this pervasive apathy from both the individual energetic level as well as the collective energetic level?
Mm-hmm. You know, Erwin Laszlo talks about the Akashic field. And I was having dinner with him about 2 years ago, and I asked him to explain that to me because it was a fairly nebulous concept to me. And he described it as an information field that we're washed in, that we're living in, and that's invisible to us. It's like water to a fish, or like air to us. And this information field, this Akashic field, this matrix, it's helpful to think of them as layers within layers, almost like these Russian dolls that nest inside each other, the matryoshkas. And we have the cultural layer, we have the biological, and then we have perhaps the planetary, the biosphere, that has its own agenda. You know, I was in the Amazon last year. Every year I lead small groups of primarily our students to go to the Amazon and to the Andes to work with some of these old wisdom keepers. And we were talking about the prophecies of 2012 and the end of time. And one of the jungle shamans says to me, "You know, Alberto, we're going to miss our white brother. We're going to miss you. The earth is going to be fine. The earth is going to do well. But we're going to miss our white brother." And he was alluding to this notion that death is programmed into every species. You know, our cells are programmed to die so that new cells can be born. There's a process called apoptosis. But some of the old wisdom keepers believe that species may also have a biological time clock, that when it, you know, when it's done, it's done. And that the efforts that many, that people like yourself are making to bring a little bit more consciousness into the system, a little bit of high-level information, because not all information is created equal, and you know the shamans differentiate between information and knowledge, and information being that knowing that water is H2O, but knowledge is being able to make it rain. And information was knowing a diagnosis, but knowledge was being able to heal. So how do you upgrade the quality of the information in the field, of the consciousness in the field? And it's not simply by bringing in more facts, but could it be that by finding states of inner peace within you, you can begin to create peace in the Middle East? That by envisioning a world that is healed, you can begin to heal your world. One of the things that stuns me today is the degree of apathy that I find in America, and that I don't find. I just came back yesterday from teaching in Europe, and my last stop was in Romania, and the enthusiasm and the social activism and the awareness that I found in this country that lived under a dictatorship for 50 years, communist dictatorship, was so refreshing in contrast with the sense of powerlessness and victimhood and entitlement that I find today in the U.S. And that maybe was really illustrated. My son and I were driving the other day in Massachusetts, and he was saying to me, you know, somebody should fix these roads. They should fix this road. And I asked him, who's they? Somebody should do something about it. And the they, of course, are us, are we. And one of the most dangerous elements in terms of the cultural trance, of the collective belief in our inability to make a difference is that it breeds apathy, it breeds despair, it breeds a sense of doom. You know, people think in 2012 the world is going to end. And what the amazing thing is that the Mayans say that what happens in 2012 is that humans appear in the world for the very first time. So so that concerns me. The sense of terrible disempowerment is a cause of concern.
Okay. I want to go back to something you just touched on, and I would like for you to talk more in depth, if you would, please. Much of your work deals with what you call the luminous energy field, which every sentient being possesses at the subtle level, and which plays a fundamental role in how we interweave our energy in our world and lives into being. You raise an interesting relationship between the energetic field and DNA, DNA being the hard wire, and this luminous energy field being the soft wire of our composition. Could you please elaborate on this even more than what you did? You just touched on it. I'd like you to really go further in this and also explain the difference between curing and healing.
Right. Well, you know, what I do today, Gary, is to train Western shamans. And what shamans are from traditional societies, and they have rattles and feathers, but what they do is mediate between the visible and the invisible world. And what I do is train modern shamans. We train a lot of doctors and non-medical people and business people, because today we have to mediate between the invisible world of ideas and of the possible into creating these in the visible, in the material world. And that's what the shaman has always done. And the mechanism for doing that is the luminous energy field. It's what Laszlo calls the Akashic field. It's a matrix. Interacting consciously with that matrix. So the biologists, for example, tell us that evolution is a set of random mutations that are guided by the principle of the survival of the strongest. The bigger the teeth, the sharper the claws, the better your chances of survival and having more mates. But the There's another perspective on evolution, which is the survival of the wisest, and not of the most brutal, but the survival of the individual that is able to download the codes for a new human directly from the biosphere, from nature. Now, these codes are downloaded through our luminous matrix that surrounds the physical body and that organizes the body in the same way that a magnet organizes iron filings on a piece of glass. So the luminous energy field is our personal matrix. Now, it's not some new age aura. It's basically created by electrical activity in our central nervous system. Because we have very long nerves to run down, up and down the body, and that conduct electricity. And perpendicular to every wire, to every electrical conductor, is a magnetic field that not only has intensity, but also has information. It has all of your biological information. And in the West, we've been very seduced by the discovery of DNA. DNA is really sexy. But DNA, what it does is to manufacture proteins. That's the only thing DNA does. And we're a protein-based life form. You know, we're protein. And DNA manufactures and replenishes proteins. Now, so DNA is the hardware. But the software that guides that process is the luminous energy field that surrounds it's the information field. And if you can download version 7.1 of the software, you can grow a new body that ages and heals and dies differently. And if you don't, then you're going to keep repeating and iterating the same illnesses and the same psychological dramas of your parents. And biology tells us that only 5% of DNA is active. The other 95% is called junk DNA. And that's because only 5% of your DNA codes for proteins. And the other 95% is just there. Well, the other 95% is the pool of human possibilities. And the minute that you can begin to select outside of the 5% that was determined by your family genetics, in fact, they call these, in the Amazon, they call them generational curses that are passed down from one generation to the next. So you don't have to express the genes for heart disease and for cancer. You can begin to select for genes that express health and longevity. And that's what the luminous energy field does. And it interfaces directly I might get a little too technical here, but the translator of the signals from the luminous energy field are the fuel factories inside each one of our cells that are known as mitochondria, and that are decimated by free radicals. And mitochondria, which generate fuel inside of our cells, the fuel for cells to reproduce, to divide, to replenish themselves, mitochondria also regulate cell signaling. So they tell cells when to commit suicide, when they have to die so that new cells can be born. Like in your skin, for example, your skin cells die every 6 days and new ones are born. Now, when the signaling is faulty, what happens is that you have cells that refuse to die. And you know what we call these cells that refuse to die. They're cancer. So when you establish, again, going back to that right relationship between you and the biosphere and the environment, so that microbes and jaguars are not looking at you as lunch. When you establish that dialogue again with nature, you upgrade the quality of the fuel factories in your cells. They're able to signal correctly, and they're like the librarian. They pull out the books that you want to read, and they can begin to pull out the books that will allow you to create health in your life.
Let me just interject a few thoughts here and then ask you to continue on.
I'm sorry if I got too technical here.
No, you did not get too technical. I think most people could understand what you were saying. If you're just tuning in, Dr. Alberto Villoldo, Villoldo, who is a psychologist and medical anthropologist, youngest clinical professor at San Francisco State University, and author of some very important work, is my guest. Now, I just want to share a thought because it happened early this morning. I've been filming. Yesterday, we filmed all day on Wall Street, and I was asking one of the people being filmed who was protesting Goldman Sachs and corporate America getting the bailout, but not the average person. I says, how does being here make you feel? And he turned into the camera, and you'll see this in the film when it comes out. Says, I felt empowered being here, and I'm sorry that I haven't gone out to protest to share my feelings before. I said, can you feel the electricity in the air? All these thousands and tens of thousands of people here protesting, it's a collective energy. And the person said, yes. Now, I want to jump back and get your thoughts on this. We've discussed in the past that I did a lot of research, not just in anti-aging medicine, which was I was the director of at the Institute of Applied Biology for 30 years, but also in psi research. And that had to be done very quietly. In fact, the lab director put me up on the third floor away from everyone because he didn't want me to end up getting fired because the very orthodox chemotherapist downstairs wouldn't have understood what I was talking about.
Right.
And would have been threatened by it. In any case, very recently, I was invited, based upon a paper that I had published on reversing some very serious illnesses that normally have never been reversed, to the World Congress on Anti-Aging Medicine and the division that was held in Washington, D.C. And I don't know how many. I was told 7,000 scientists. It was just a humongous hall, and everybody sitting there with their laptops. You couldn't ask questions because there were too many people, but you would email the moderator, and then they would select the question that went up on this screen behind you, and then you would address it. And each of us who were keynote speakers had 40 minutes. Well, I was supposed to do a presentation on reversing menopausal symptoms. And I've done 47 clinical studies, and most have been published and have been presented before scientific groups. And I'm watching all day one boring lecture after another where these people want to get some research money because they feel if they can manipulate this particular gene or this stem cell that it will help possibly reduce some of the symptoms of different illnesses. And the biggest groups were either in cancer, heart disease, or mental or brain impairments. And so at the last moment, as I'm walking up on the stage, I decided to shift the emphasis. So I got up there and I said, I'm hearing some very important work being discussed, and I appreciate being here with all of you, but I want to step outside of this model for a moment. We talk about helping people with Alzheimer's and autism and Asperger syndrome and other conditions, and how we have to manipulate particular DNA. And I don't question that, but most of you are suggesting it's years away, maybe even decades away. I would like to offer you an anomaly. And with that, I brought out three people on the stage. And I said, here is a woman. And I introduced the woman. She spoke, very articulate. And I just asked her a few questions. And I'm sure the people in the audience say, what's this about? Where is this going? Who is this person? And then I said, this woman, his name is Marie McGovern. And Marie McGovern had end-stage Alzheimer's. Today, she is probably 90 to 95% improved. And I said, when I first met her 2.5 years ago, at that point it was 2 years ago, and if you saw the video of it, you would say, yeah, that's a typical person with end-stage Charlton Heston, Ronald Reagan Alzheimer's. And I said, today she is the only person I'm aware of in the United States that has ever had this much of a regression, and it's sustained and it's improving. By the way, that was even before just 2 weeks ago, or 3 weeks ago, when Marie McGovern came into a studio in New York and did a film, which is now up on my website. You can go and say it's a section that says miracles still happen. And you can see in her own words, split screen, before and after. It's rather amazing. And then I brought up John Ortega with his two wonderful parents who have both New York City from Brooklyn, Bed-Stuy, police officers. And their son, Jonathan, had full spectrum autism, could not communicate, was destructive, et cetera, and they were going to put him in an institution. Today, he is number one in his class at a regular school with honors every week. Completely normal, no autism at all. And then the final person had reversed all the menopause, but she also reversed hepatitis, herpes, fibrocystic breast, fibroids, adult acne, chronic fatigue syndrome, all these conditions, plus hot flashes, thinning of the skin, weakness, loss of muscle mass, and was literally premenopausal now. And I said, so here you have three models. Now, what they all have in common is that what really caused this to happen was an energy exchange. They exchanged what they were doing in the lifestyle they were living that was causing inflammation, and inflammation in one part of the body will go to other parts as well, because the bloodstream carries them there, cytokines. And I said every choice they made had to be an energy-positive choice. I said, now, there are people I could not bring here, but there are 1,500 other people, 1,500 people that I have on film with end-stage cancers and other things that also have had this. I said, so then the question is, how did this? Is it a drug? Is it a nutrient? What is it? And I said, it's not a drug. None of these people took drugs. I said it was first and foremost them believing that they had a power greater in them than what they had used up to that point.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, it was believing in the power of the collective energy around them, the epigenetic energy, the energy of nature, spending time mm-hmm. with nature, time alone, time with positive people that give you positive and loving input, not negative, highly critical people that give you destructive input. And it was also making only choices that you would be happy with the outcome of the choice. So raw juices, raw food, sprouts, gourmet, wonderful vegan meals, but vegan, nothing with a heartbeat or a face. And the supplements that would help rebalance the body chemistry, detox it, and chelate it. And the total cumulative effect of all that put together is this. And then the first email that came up on the big screen behind me was, do you have a proof of a single change DNA in a dish? And I said, sir, this is 100 trillion change DNA. How in the world can you look at people, hear their stories, and see people who have absolute proof that they had these conditions today that don't? You had to change everything, not just the symptoms, but the whole person changed. And I said, these are happy people today. This one person wasn't happy. Now they're happy. Mm-hmm. I said, it's changing the energy field, subtle
Absolutely.
Energy field. And
DNA.
You can see people. Yep. Yeah, you can see, and I said, the energy field affects the DNA.
Yep.
And I said, we can prove that today. And I said, look, I, and my final comment is, I said, I deal with terminal cancer patients all the time, people with advanced AIDS. And I said, I don't give them a protocol, what to go home and eat. The very first thing I do, the first time I meet people, is I ask them, what do you have to live for? And almost without exception, it's nothing.
Yeah.
So my job is to try to get them to believe that there is still something to live for, and that belief then is what you start to work with. It's a thin little thread that you have to weave into a new life to help that person. And then once they finally believe that life is worth living and that they can live a life and do things now that they never did before, then you can start to incorporate that positive energy. And that's how, but if you talk with the average physician, they're just saying, I don't understand what the hell you're saying. But afterwards, out in the hall, I'm going to guess 600 to 700 people came out, the scientists, the physicians, saying, what went on in there? Then they started talking with these people. How did this happen? And I said to them, if any of you want to come to New York, I'm happy to introduce you to thousands of people. I'm happy this has happened to. I'm happy to show you. Not a single person has taken me up on my offer. Your thoughts, please.
You know, we're so invested in our belief systems. And And the reason I went to the Amazon to study the healers there is that I recognize that the most carefully studied phenomena in medicine, in pharmaceutical medicine, is the placebo effect, because every medication is tested against the placebo. And if Viagra is, you know, if a placebo is 83% as effective as Viagra and 70% as effective as morphine, what if we could use these mechanisms consciously instead of trying to trick the person? And that's what led me to spend time with these shamans that didn't have any access to technology like we do, but knew how to work with what we would call the healing resources of the mind. But it was much bigger than that. It's the luminous energy field. It's the information field of the planet. And absolutely, I agree with you. You need to detoxify. You need to reduce inflammation. And you need to start giving the body what it needs, but you need to start giving the soul what it needs first. And you need to have hope, and you need to have a positive outlook. But what the shamans discovered is that all of the predispositions that we have for illnesses that run in our family, that's just one worldview. That's not real. That's simply one way of looking at health and illness. That all of these predispositions are encoded in your luminous energy field. They're signatures, they're imprints. And if you can upgrade the quality of that information, because it's at the end, it's information, if you can erase that imprint, then you can unblock the body's natural healing systems and the body comes back to health. But you also need to reestablish a dialogue with nature, with your inner nature, and with the trees, with the rivers. And when I look at our mythology, you know, we have a very funky mythology in the West. For example, we have the only mythology in the planet in which we were kicked out of the Garden of Eden. And nobody else was kicked out of the garden. The Aborigines weren't, the Sub-Saharan Africans weren't, the Native Americans weren't. They were given the garden to be the caretakers and the stewards of the garden. But when we still lived in the garden, we were able to speak to the rivers and to the trees and to God. And there's a wonderful story about when the conquistadors arrived in the New World, and they brought with them the Bible, and they came to one of the Inca shaman priests. And they gave him the Bible, and they said, "Here, this is the word of God." And the shaman put the book to his ear and listened. And after a moment, he threw it down, and he said, "What kind of God is this that does not speak?" And he asked the priest, "When did your God last speak to you?" And the priest, this is in the year 1500 and something, the priest said, "1500 years ago. Why, when did your God last speak to you?" And the Inca said, "This morning at breakfast." So these are living cultures that have an active dialogue with nature, and that speak to the rivers and to the trees and to the sky. And the sky and the rivers and the trees speak back to them. Now, this is referring not just to a verbal dialogue, but to a luminous, energetic dialogue that we're having continually with nature. So, for example, in the West, we think of food only as fuel, but food is information. Everything that you eat has information in it about where it grew, about the soil, about the moon when it rose, about the sun, about the bugs that came and lived there, about all of your environment. And you're taking this into your system, and it's informing the system. But there's subtler kinds of information that we pick up daily from the environment. Now, what the shamans learned to do was to upgrade the quality of the information in the luminous energy field. So it did not have, so it became more conscious. So it was not driven by the karmic or generational patterns of of illness, but so you could participate consciously in selecting your states of health. And the source of this is in the shamanic mythology, because the Western mythology says that on the seventh day, God rested, and all that was left was the naming of the plants and the animals. But the shamanic mythology says that on the seventh day, the Great Spirit said, you know, I created the river, I created the whales and the eagles and the butterflies. Aren't they beautiful? And now you finish it. You complete creation. And what this mythology is saying is that we can actively participate in our evolution, that we can dream ourselves into being who we're becoming emotionally, intellectually, even physically, biologically. We have all of those resources today. And I speak about that in several of my books, particularly in the book Shaman, Healer, Sage, that describes all of the techniques and methodologies for upgrading and upregulating the quality of your luminous matrix. And as you do so, you also improve the quality, you create peace around you. You bring peace to your family, to your neighborhood. And if enough of us do it, we bring peace to the world.
That's good. One last question for you, and that is, since the Enlightenment, there has been a continuum of a desacralization of life, not only of nature, but also the stages we go through the human steps of birth and womanhood, manhood, first love, marriage, parenthood, sagehood, when we become elders in our society, and death. And are actually life initiations that we should imbue with more sacred meaning. Yet each of these stages of life, initiations as it were, are accompanied by obstacles and have their negative counterparts seem to now be quite pervasive in our culture. So would you take us briefly through each of these and shed insight on how each stage might be understood from a shamanic vantage point? Right. We have 8 minutes to go.
Okay. You know, the shamanic perspective is the perspective of the feminine, in contrast with the very masculine science and masculine culture, masculine God that we have. But in my book, Illumination, which has just come out, it speaks specifically about these great rites of initiation, and how when you miss one of these initiations, your growth becomes stunted. Like if you miss your initiation of birth, we're all born biologically, but if we're not celebrated and born into an environment that's safe, then our growth is stunted. If when we reach puberty, we don't go through the rites of manhood and womanhood, we become lifelong children. We're 30-year-olds who want to move back in with mommy and daddy. And if we go through a bar mitzvah, and it's become a party. It's not a rite of becoming a man or a woman. And in fact, when I ask people in my audiences, when I speak, I ask the men, do you remember your rites of initiation as a man? Inevitably, somebody says, yes. We went out and bought condoms and a six-pack and hoped that we got lucky. So you're not welcomed into the company of men. And then your growth becomes stunted. You remain a boy child. You're not welcomed into the company of women. And then you remain a princess, a little girl, your entire life. And the problem is that princesses don't age gracefully. You've got to become queenly. If you go through your rite of first love and you don't complete that, then you spend your life looking for the perfect partner, for the perfect mate. I've got a friend of mine that invited me recently to his wedding, and it's his fifth wedding. And I refused to go. I said, you have to stop looking for the right partner and work on becoming the right partner. Because he was saying to me, Alberto, it's different this time. You've got to meet her. If we go through our, if we become parents, you can become a biological parent without going through your rite of parenthood. Suddenly you have this little creature in your life you don't know what to do with. And as men, we often tend to run away because we don't have the 9 months of incubation that a woman has. So we're never able to be competent parents, which is why so much of our Western psychology is based on blaming our parents for their lacks, because they never went through this initiation themselves. If you, and today, of course, we also have the initiation of divorce, and then you come to your initiation of sagehood, where you become a wise man or a wise woman. It's biological, the biological counterpart is menopause. But you can go through menopause or andropause for a man and still remain a fool. Never enter into your own sagehood or embrace your own wisdom. You can be a 50-year-old woman who's still trying to dress up like a 17-year-old, or a 60-year-old man who thinks what will save him is a young bride. And then, of course, we have the great initiation, which is our death. And if we have the earlier rites of initiation, we're not able to die gracefully and at peace. Now, the beauty of it is that you can make up any one of these initiations at any point in your life. You can recreate a rite of passage for yourself where you're born into a world that's safe. But you have to do it in the company of friends. You cannot do it alone. You can create a rite of passage as a woman where you're, even in your, I remember one of our students, a woman who's 74 years old, went through her puberty rites, her first menstruation rites at the age of 74, by reenacting, creating a sacred circle of women who welcomed her as a woman. Because she had never matured. She had been a little girl all her life. So in my book, Illumination, I'm looking at these biological passages, but looking at them as a shaman looks at them as traditional initiations that take us, that give us the opportunity for illumination, for becoming illumined. And I'm arguing in the book that illumination and enlightenment has been hijacked by religion. That is really the result of you going through sacred passages throughout your life that bring you to an illumined way of life, an enlightened way of perceiving the world, and not this sudden flash of light that reveals everything in the universe to you. And of course, we're a society that's become stuck in our initiation into adulthood. We're a society that of children in many ways that feel entitled to be looked after and cared for by mommy and daddy.
We're out of time once again. Thank
Gary,
you very much.
Happy to be on your show again.
Always a pleasure. Give us your website name, please.
www.the4winds.com. The Four Winds. FourWinds.com.
I look forward to our next conversation.
Thanks, Gary. Bye-bye.